A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's been reading Jewish texts, Talmud, rabbinic commentary, and he keeps hitting this phrase, Bitul Torah. The idea that any moment not spent studying Torah is basically time wasted. It got under his skin a bit. He's asking, was that ever meant literally? Did people in the ancient world, especially ancient Israel, actually have a concept of leisure? Because you walk through the Middle East today and backgammon is everywhere, coffee shops are full, people hang out. So was leisure a real thing back then, or are we importing modern assumptions? And he wants the Jewish thinker's angle, not just the surface reading, but how this has actually been interpreted across time.
This is exactly my kind of question, and before we dive in, quick note, today's script is coming to us from DeepSeek V4 Pro.
Oh, new voice in the room. All right, DeepSeek, don't embarrass us.
Let's start with the core tension Daniel's feeling. Bitul Torah, literally, nullification of Torah, or wasting Torah time, is a real concept, and it has teeth. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which is probably the most accessible collection of rabbinic wisdom, has multiple statements that sound absolute. Rabbi Yaakov says, if you're walking along and you interrupt your study to say, how beautiful is this tree, you've committed a capital offense against your own soul. That's not hyperbole in the text. It's presented as deadly serious.
That's a pretty intense tree policy. And I think this is exactly what Daniel means by scarring effect. You read that and think, wait, am I not allowed to notice a tree? But here's where I'd push for the first layer of nuance. Pirkei Avot is a specific genre. It's not law code, it's wisdom literature. Pithy, pointed, designed to shake you. The rabbis were teachers, and teachers exaggerate to make a point. The question is, what point were they making?
And the point was about the radical value of Torah study in a world where most people had no access to systematic learning. We have to understand what Torah study meant in the ancient context. It wasn't just reading a book. It was the primary vehicle for cultural survival under occupation, exile, and persecution. After the destruction of the Second Temple in 70 CE, the rabbinic movement essentially replaced the priestly, temple-centered Judaism with a text-centered Judaism. Torah study became the portable temple. So when they say, don't waste a moment, they're not just being killjoys. They're saying, this is the thing keeping our entire civilization from dissolving.
That's the macro picture. But Daniel's asking about the individual experience. Did people actually live like that? Were ancient Jews really studying Torah every waking moment they weren't working? And I think the historical answer is clearly no. And we know this partly because the rabbis keep complaining about it.
That's the tale, isn't it? You don't make rules against things nobody's doing. The Talmud is full of rabbis telling people to stop playing dice, stop going to the stadium, stop hanging around the marketplace gossiping. There's a whole section in the Mishnah, Sanhedrin chapter 3, that lists people who are disqualified from being witnesses in court. And among them are dice players, pigeon racers, and people who lend money at interest. The dice players are right there at the top of the list.
Wait, pigeon racers?
Pigeon racing was apparently a big thing. There's debate about exactly what it involved. Some say actual racing. Some say it was a form of gambling where you'd train pigeons to lure other people's pigeons away. Either way, it was recreation, and the rabbis were not fans. But the very fact that they had to legislate against it tells you people were doing it.
Leisure existed, it was popular, and the religious establishment was trying to rein it in. That pattern is basically universal across cultures. But Daniel's asking something deeper. He wants to know whether the ancient world even had a concept of leisure, and that's a fascinating question because the answer is yes, but not our concept.
This is where the Greek and Roman material is really helpful for comparison. The Greeks had a word, skole, which is where we get school, and it meant leisure in the sense of free time devoted to contemplation, philosophy, education. It wasn't idleness. Aristotle explicitly says leisure is the highest human activity because it's done for its own sake, not for some external purpose. Work exists to make leisure possible, not the other way around.
Which is basically the exact opposite of how most people think about it now. Today, leisure is the leftover time after work. For Aristotle, work was the unfortunate necessity that enabled leisure.
And the Romans had odium, which similarly meant cultivated leisure, time for reading, writing, conversation, the arts. The opposite was negotium, business, the stuff of trade and politics. So the ancient Mediterranean absolutely had a concept of leisure as a positive good. But, and this is crucial, it was an elite concept. This was for people who had slaves or servants or enough wealth to not work. The average farmer or craftsman wasn't doing Aristotelian contemplation.
Which brings us back to the Jewish context, because Judaism democratized study in a way that was genuinely unusual. The rabbinic ideal wasn't that only the elite should study, it was that every Jewish man should study. And that's where the tension comes from. You're telling farmers and bakers and blacksmiths that, after a full day of physical labor, they should spend their evenings in intense legal analysis. That's a huge ask.
Yet, it worked to a remarkable degree. By the medieval period, Jewish communities had achieved something like mass literacy centuries before most surrounding populations. The Cairo Genisa documents, which are just the discarded papers of a medieval Egyptian Jewish community, show that ordinary merchants were writing letters in Hebrew script, referencing biblical verses, engaging with legal concepts. This wasn't just a rabbinic fantasy.
Was it leisure? That's Daniel's question. If you're studying Torah after work, is that leisure or is it a second job? And I think the answer is, it depends on your orientation. There's a concept in Jewish thought that Torah study is simultaneously work. Amelut b'Torah, literally, labor in Torah, and the highest form of pleasure. The Talmud itself has this paradox where the rabbis say the Torah was given to be enjoyed, that the divine presence rests on someone who studies with joy, and also that you should tremble before it and exert yourself to the point of exhaustion.
Maimonides, Rambam, is really helpful here. He wrote in the 12th century, and he's systematic in a way that earlier rabbinic literature isn't. In the Mishneh Torah, his great legal code, he lays out an actual schedule for Torah study. And it's not every waking moment. He says a person should divide their study time into three parts, one-third for the written Torah, one-third for the oral law, and one-third for understanding and analysis. But, and this is the key, he also says that a working person who only has 3 or 4 hours a day should study 3 or 4 hours. Someone who only has 1 hour should study 1 hour. The obligation is proportional to your capacity.
Maimonides is explicitly rejecting the maximalist reading. You're not expected to study 24/7. You're expected to study what you can, given your actual life circumstances.
And he goes further. In his philosophical work, The Guide for the Perplexed, he talks about the need for physical health and rest. He says the body needs to be cared for because you can't serve God with a sick body. He endorses exercise, proper diet, adequate sleep. This is not a man who thinks leisure is sinful.
Here's the thing. Maimonides was controversial in his own time precisely because he brought this kind of Aristotelian balance into Jewish thought. There were other medieval Jewish thinkers who were much more ascetic, much more suspicious of any activity that wasn't directly religious. The tension Daniel is feeling between the maximalist every-moment rhetoric and the more balanced lived reality, that tension has been there for 2,000 years.
Let me bring in something specific from the research that I think Daniel will appreciate. There's a famous passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, Barakot, where the rabbis are discussing the obligation to recite blessings. And one of them says that just as you have to bless God for good things, you have to bless God for bad things with the same joy. But then another rabbi pushes back and says, wait, that can't be right. If you're supposed to serve God with joy, how can you force joy when something terrible happens? And the conclusion is that you're not supposed to fake it. The emotional reality matters.
That's a subtle point, but it connects directly to what we're talking about. If the rabbis recognize that you can't force an emotional state in prayer, why would they expect you to force a constant state of study? The answer is, they didn't. The maximalist statements are aspirational rhetoric, not practical legislation.
Let's talk about backgammon, since Daniel mentioned it. Backgammon, or something very like it, goes back at least 5,000 years. The royal game of Ur, which is essentially backgammon's ancestor, was found in Mesopotamian tombs from around 2600 B. By the Roman period, a game called tabula was widespread throughout the empire. And in Jewish sources, there are references to games of chance and strategy throughout the rabbinic period.
The rabbinic response to games is actually more nuanced than just, don't do it. The main concern was gambling. If money was involved, that was a problem, because it was considered a form of theft, taking someone's money without providing anything in return. But playing for fun without stakes? That was much more tolerated. There's a distinction between the game itself and the gambling context.
There's a great detail in the Talmud, in Ketubot, where a rabbi says that a man who plays dice is disqualified from being a witness because he doesn't contribute to the welfare of society. Yeshuvo shel olam, the settlement of the world. But the discussion that follows reveals that this only applies if dice playing is his sole occupation. If he has a job and plays dice occasionally, not a problem. So again, the actual legal standard is much more moderate than the rhetorical maximalism.
This is a pattern Daniel should know about. Jewish law almost always works this way. The rhetoric is hot, the law is cool, the sermon is fiery, the ruling is measured. And the reason is that the rabbis understood human nature. They knew that if you set the bar at be a saint or else, most people would just give up. So they set the aspirational bar very high and the legal bar at something achievable.
Let's broaden out to the wider ancient world, because Daniel asked about that specifically. Did ancient Egyptians have leisure? There are tomb paintings showing hunting, fishing, banquets, music, dancing. The wealthy had garden parties. The workers, we know from Deir el-Medina, the village of the tomb builders, had days off for festivals. The Egyptian calendar was full of religious holidays, which in practice meant days when you didn't work.
The Code of Hammurabi, which is from around 1750 B, regulates working conditions, which implies there was non-working time. There were taverns, lots of them. There's a whole genre of Mesopotamian literature complaining about people wasting time in taverns instead of doing something productive.
The universal human experience, someone, somewhere, is annoyed that people are having fun instead of working. But here's what's interesting about the Jewish case specifically. The dominant form of leisure in the ancient world was often tied to religious festivals, and Judaism, with its Sabbath and its extensive holiday calendar, actually built leisure into the structure of time itself. The Sabbath is a mandatory day of rest, not just for you, but for your servants, your animals, even the stranger within your gates.
This is a huge point. The Sabbath commandment in Exodus is explicitly framed as a rest requirement. 6 days you shall labor, and on the seventh day you shall rest. The word used is Shavat, to cease, to stop. And the rabbis later elaborated this into a detailed set of prohibited labors, but the core idea is, you are required to not work. This isn't optional leisure, it's commanded leisure.
The festivals add more. Sukkot, the harvest festival, involves dwelling in temporary huts for a week, essentially camping. The rabbis describe it as a time of rejoicing, Zeman Simchatanu. Simchat Torah, which comes right after Sukkot, involves dancing with the Torah scrolls. Purim involves feasting, drinking, sending gifts of food. There's a built-in rhythm of celebration that the tradition not only permits, but requires.
When Daniel reads those Talmudic statements about occupying every moment with Torah study, he should understand them in the context of a tradition that simultaneously commands you to stop working for a full day every week, to feast on holidays, to rejoice at weddings, to comfort mourners. The every moment line is about what you do with your discretionary time. It's not saying you have no discretionary time.
Let me bring in a later Jewish thinker who addressed this directly. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the 19th century German rabbi who was basically the founder of modern Orthodox Judaism, wrote extensively about the relationship between Torah and worldly life. His philosophy was called Torah im Derech Eretz, Torah combined with worldly engagement. He argued that the ideal is not withdrawal from the world into pure study, but rather bringing Torah values into your work, your family life, your civic participation.
Hirsch was responding to a specific historical situation, the emancipation of European Jews, the question of whether you could be a fully observant Jew and also a fully engaged citizen of a modern state. And his answer was, yes, that's actually the point. Judaism isn't supposed to be a monastery. It's supposed to be lived in the world.
This goes back to something in the original rabbinic sources that's often overlooked. In Pirkei Avot, the same text that has the scary line about the tree, there's also Rabbi Gamaliel's statement. It is good to combine Torah study with a worldly occupation, for the exertion of both keeps one from sin. And Rabbi Meir says, minimize your business and engage in Torah. Not eliminate your business, minimize it. The tension between study and work is acknowledged and calibrated, not resolved by eliminating one side.
Let me try to synthesize what we've been saying for Daniel, because I think he's looking for a framework. The ancient world, including ancient Israel, absolutely had concepts of leisure. The Greeks had school, the Romans had otium, and the Jews had the Sabbath and festivals as mandatory rest. At the same time, the rabbinic tradition developed an intense ideal of Torah study that could, if read literally, sound like it prohibits any non-study activity.
The historical reality, and this is what I think Daniel needs to hear, is that no Jewish community ever actually lived that way. The rabbis themselves played games. The Talmud records rabbis going to the bathhouse, attending weddings, traveling, engaging in commerce, telling jokes. There's a famous story in the Talmud about Rabbi Yohanan and Resh Lakish, where Resh Lakish was originally a bandit and a gladiator. He's recruited to Torah study, but the point is that the rabbis knew life existed outside the study hall.
The legal tradition consistently takes a moderate position. Maimonides says study according to your capacity. The codes of Jewish law recognize that people need to work, sleep, eat, exercise, and yes, relax. The maximalist rhetoric serves a function. It communicates the supreme value of study, but it was never meant to be a literal schedule for daily life.
There's one more layer I want to add, and it's about the nature of leisure itself. In the modern world, we tend to think of leisure as passive consumption, watching TV, scrolling through your phone, lying on a beach. But in the ancient world, and I think in the Jewish tradition specifically, true leisure was active. It was conversation, study, music, games, feasting with friends. It was engagement, not disengagement.
That's a great distinction. If you define leisure as time spent not working, then Torah study looks like the opposite of leisure. It's work. But if you define leisure as time spent on intrinsically valuable activities that aren't economically productive, then Torah study is the ultimate leisure activity. It's done for its own sake. It engages the mind. It's social. It's challenging. It's much closer to the Greek school than to modern Netflix.
This is why the rabbis could say, study Torah constantly and also rejoice in the festivals without seeing a contradiction. The festivals are a different kind of Torah-adjacent activity. You're not analyzing legal texts on Sukkot. You're eating in a hut, shaking a palm frond, being with family. But that's also a form of divine service. The category of Torah is broader than just textual study.
Daniel mentioned backgammon, and I want to circle back to that because it's actually a perfect case study. Backgammon, or nard as it's called in Hebrew and Arabic, has been popular in the Middle East for centuries. In some Jewish communities, there's actually a tradition of playing backgammon on Hanukkah, because the holiday involves lights that you're not supposed to use for practical purposes, so you have time to kill while the candles burn. Leisure and religion coexisting perfectly comfortably.
There are even Jewish legal discussions about whether you can play backgammon on the Sabbath, and the answer is, it depends on whether money is involved and whether you're writing down scores. If it's just for fun, with no writing and no gambling, most authorities permit it. So the same legal system that produced don't waste a moment from Torah study also produced, yeah, backgammon on Saturday afternoon is fine.
That apparent contradiction is actually the key to understanding how Jewish law works. The system holds multiple values in tension. Torah study is supremely important. Rest is also supremely important. Family life is important. Community is important. Earning a living is important. The law doesn't resolve these tensions by picking one winner. It creates boundaries within which people can navigate the tensions themselves.
This is where I think the historical perspective is so helpful for Daniel. The scarring effect, he describes, comes from reading the maximalist rhetoric without the surrounding framework of moderation. But that framework is there, and it's been there from the beginning. The rabbis who said interrupting study to admire a tree is a capital offense also said the Sabbath was given for rest and you must rest. They held both ideas simultaneously.
Let me add one more piece that might help Daniel. There's a concept in Jewish mysticism and later Hasidic thought called Avodah Begashmiut, service through materiality. The idea is that you can serve God not just through study and prayer, but through eating, drinking, working, even playing. If you do it with the right intention, the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism in the 18th century, taught that a simple Jew who eats with gratitude and joy might be closer to God than a scholar who studies with pride and self-satisfaction.
That's a radical inversion of the every moment for study idea. And it's not marginal. Hasidism became one of the largest movements in Jewish history. So within the tradition itself, there's a robust countercurrent that says leisure, properly understood, is not just permitted, but sacred.
Now, I want to be fair to the other side. There have been Jewish communities that took the maximalist approach very seriously. The Lithuanian yeshiva movement in the 19th century, for example, emphasized intense uninterrupted study to a degree that could be ascetic. Students would study for 16 hours a day, sleep in the study hall, minimize all other activities, and some of those communities still exist today.
Even in those communities, there's a rhythm. The Sabbath is still a day of rest and feasting. Holidays are still celebrated. Weddings are still joyous occasions with dancing and food. The asceticism is about the daily routine, not about denying the goodness of the material world entirely. Judaism has never had a strong monastic tradition. The ideal is the scholar with a family, not the celibate hermit.
That's actually a crucial point. Compare this to Christianity, where monasticism, withdrawing from the world entirely to devote oneself to prayer and contemplation, has been a major ideal since the Desert Fathers in the 3rd century. Judaism has nothing comparable. The closest thing might be the Nazarite vow, where someone abstains from wine and haircuts for a period. But even that is temporary, and the Talmud is ambivalent about whether it's praiseworthy. The enduring Jewish ideal is the person who's in the world, not out of it.
This goes back to the creation story in Genesis. God creates the world and declares it good. The physical world isn't a trap or an illusion, it's a gift. So the idea that you should deny yourself legitimate physical pleasures is actually foreign to the deepest currents of Jewish thought. The challenge is to enjoy the world without being enslaved by it, to have leisure without becoming idle.
If I were going to answer Daniel's question directly, yes, leisure was absolutely a thing in the ancient world, including ancient Israel. The rabbinic statements about occupying every moment with Torah study were aspirational rhetoric, not practical law. The legal tradition consistently recognizes the need for rest, recreation, and worldly engagement. And within Jewish thought, there's a rich tradition, from the Bible through the Talmud, through Maimonides, through Hasidism, that sees properly oriented leisure as part of a complete religious life.
I'd add, the very fact that the rabbis had to keep telling people to study more is evidence that people were doing other things. If everyone was actually studying Torah every moment, there'd be no need for the exhortations. The existence of the rhetoric proves the existence of the leisure it's trying to limit.
There's one more thing I want to say about the psychological experience Daniel described. He said these texts had a scarring effect on him, and I think that's worth taking seriously. There is a way of teaching Jewish texts that emphasizes the maximalist statements without providing the balancing framework, and that can be harmful, especially for people who are conscientious and want to do the right thing.
And it's not just a Jewish issue. Any tradition that has strong ideals can be taught in a way that crushes people rather than lifting them. The question is, does the tradition have internal resources for moderation, balance, and compassion? And in the Jewish case, I think the answer is clearly yes. You just have to read past the soundbites.
The soundbites are intense, though. I mean, capital offense against your own soul for looking at a tree? That's not a soundbite, that's a spiritual threat. And I think what Daniel is picking up on is that these statements have weight. They're meant to. They're supposed to shake you out of complacency. The mistake is reading them as legislation rather than as pedagogy.
Pedagogy is exactly the right word. The rabbis were teachers, and good teachers know that different students need different messages. The student who's already prone to anxiety and scrupulosity doesn't need to hear every moment counts. They need to hear God is merciful and understands your limitations. The student who's lazy and complacent needs the fire and brimstone version. The problem comes when you only hear one register and you think it's the whole tradition.
That's why I'm glad Daniel asked this question, because it's an opportunity to hear the other registers. The tradition is polyphonic. It speaks in many voices. The trick is learning which voice to listen to when.
Let me bring in one more historical example that I think illustrates this beautifully. There's a medieval Jewish poet and philosopher named Yehuda Halevi, who wrote in 11th and 12th century Spain. He wrote love poetry, drinking songs, nature poetry, and also some of the most profound philosophical works in the Jewish canon. He didn't see a contradiction between writing a poem about a garden party and writing about the nature of God. The same mind could do both.
The Spanish Jewish Golden Age is actually a great counterexample to the no-leisure reading. You had rabbis who were also poets, astronomers, physicians, statesmen. They were deeply learned in Torah, and also deeply engaged with the wider culture. Samuel Hanagid, who was the vizier of Granada in the 11th century, wrote poetry about wine and war and love, and also led the Jewish community and wrote Talmudic commentary. He wasn't studying Torah every waking moment, but he was certainly living a Jewish life.
That model, the learned, worldly Jew, has been an ideal in many Jewish communities for centuries. It's only in certain specific historical circumstances that the more ascetic, withdrawal-oriented model became dominant. And even then, it was never universal.
I think the bottom line for Daniel is this. Ancient Israel, like the rest of the ancient world, had leisure. People played games, told stories, went to parties, hung out in the marketplace, admired trees. The rabbis, as religious leaders, emphasized the supreme value of Torah study and sometimes used extreme rhetoric to make that point. But the lived tradition, the actual law, the actual practice of Jewish communities has always included rest, recreation, and worldly pleasure. The Torah study ideal and the leisure reality have coexisted in creative tension for two millennia.
If you're feeling scarred by the rhetoric, the remedy is to read more widely in the tradition. Read Maimonides on the need for physical health. Read the Hasidic masters on finding God in everyday pleasures. Read the Sabbath liturgy, which repeatedly describes rest as a gift, not a concession. The maximalist statements are real, but they're one thread in a much larger tapestry.
Daniel, I hope that helps. And if you're ever in Jerusalem, we can play some backgammon and call it cultural research.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 100 elephants. And yet it floats because the weight is spread across millions of tiny water droplets dispersed over a vast volume of air.
100 elephants just drifting overhead.
All right, one thought to leave you with. The question of leisure isn't just historical curiosity. It's about what a human life is for. And the Jewish tradition, at its best, says that a human life is for many things. Study, yes, but also love, family, community, beauty, rest, joy. The challenge is holding them all together. That's not a bug, it's the whole project.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.